very honored and very grateful to be with all of you today. This very holy place in the Himalayas, the banks of Mother Ganga, Rishikesh. This very, very beautiful Ananda Prakash Ashram. I came a little late, so I didn't meet anybody, so I don't know anyone's names, but whoever you are, I thank you. I was asked to speak something about this book that I wrote, The Journey Home. So nice to see. One of my best friends, who was on his deathbed, made me promise to write this book. His name was Bhakti Tirtha Swami. He was an African-American man. He was born in 1950 in the ghettos of Cleveland, Ohio. In those days, if you were born in the ghetto, it was almost for certain that you would live and die in the ghetto. Although the American Constitution promises freedom, at that time, freedom was for those who were not minorities. The civil rights movement was blazing. But this young boy, by his determination, by his enthusiasm, he got a full scholarship to Princeton University, became president of his class. He was a civil rights leader in the 1960s at that college, and later became a Swami. Met our Gurudev, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Prabhupada, and took to the path of bhakti, or devotion. And among the people that were taking guidance for him were Muhammad Ali, Nelson Mandela, Alice Coltrane, and literally tens and thousands of others. He wrote many books. He traveled around the world. And he called me to his bedside in Pennsylvania of the USA, where he said he only had a few days to live. And he asked me to remain with him as long as he lived. So since all the doctors and everyone said he only had a few days, I promised. But he stayed around another 8 weeks. And those were some of the most precious, beautiful moments of my life. Because when a man is dying, especially such a saintly, spiritual person as him, you really understand how precious time is. Unfortunately, sometimes we forget that we're all dying, and that time is precious for every one of us. There's a beautiful story about 5 millennia back. There was a king named Parikshit who was cursed to die in 7 days. And what do you think he did with his 7 days? He left his throne, which was at that time in Hastinapur, now Delhi, and he came to the bank of the Ganges River. Mother Ganga. He decided, I will not eat, and I will not drink, and I will not sleep. I just want to hear the glories of the Lord from the great sages, satsang, on the bank of the Ganges. And all the great rishis and sages and mystics, they all assembled from all over the world. to be with him. Because at that time, people had mystical powers. They could travel much faster than we do in airplanes. There was thousands of great rishis. And among them, they chose one to speak, who they considered the most qualified of all of them. His name was Shukadev. He was only 16 years old. But he had such wisdom, such realization, such compassion. And King Parikshit, he asked three questions. Because he didn't have time to go to college and study comparative religion. He didn't have time to read all scriptures and find out what he wanted to follow. He asked of all the great scriptures and all the great literatures in the world, what is the essence? What is the foremost duty for all people at all times, in all places, and in all circumstances? And what is the primary of a person about to die? Shukadev Goswami answered those questions. And that was recorded by his father, Vedavyas, in the form of the Bhagavad Purana, or Srimad Bhagavatam. It's 18,000 verses. He knew he had 7 days. But actually, no one in this world knows for sure we even have 7 minutes. Padam padam yadvi padam nateshyam. Life is precious. And this human life is very precious. According to the Padma Purana, there are 8,400,000 species of life within the universe. For the Atma, the soul, to enter into the human form is very rare. Atato Brahma Jigyasa, the Brahma Sutra tells us. And now you have taken this human form of life, your foremost duty is to inquire into what the truth is. What is beyond all these changing transformations of creation? Who am I? What is the purpose of life? Who is God? What is my relationship with God? Why is there suffering? Is there solutions to suffering? What is real happiness? When we ask these questions, then the actual purpose of human life begins. So sitting on the bank of the Ganga, not far from here, in a place called Shukatal, it's actually between Rishikesh and Delhi if you drive. If you go left on the road, just about 20 minutes, half hour, is it? Then there's a banyan tree, and that's where this took place. These beautiful shrines, it has been worshipped since the last 5,000 years. Time is so precious. And how we utilize our time, that is the real wisdom. Just yesterday, I was invited to an unusual event. This little Swami was invited to be the keynote speaker of the All Indian Managers Association. And it was the second annual symposium on marketing. And there were all these CEOs and presidents of airlines and big companies and banks. It was, to get in for each session was 10,000 rupees. But I got in for free because I was a speaker. Anyways, everyone was dressed up very, very formally with suits and ties and gowns. And I was wondering what, I asked the person, the president of this organization, what do you want this Swami to speak about? Recently, I spoke at the HSBC Bank headquarters in London, England, Canary Wharf, and there were 900 bankers that assembled to hear a lecture I was invited to give. They asked me to speak on the subject of unity in diversity from a banker's perspective. And I told them that I'm very grateful to be here. This is how I opened my speech. I said, but it's really quite amazing that you invited me to speak to you. This is one of the greatest banks in the world, and you're all among the greatest bankers in the world. And myself, I have not had a bank account or signed a check since 1969, 41 years. They looked at me like I was an alien from the most distant planet in the universe. Some of them gasped, like, what? How could you live without a bank account? How could you live without a checking account? Somehow I'm living. Anyways, I haven't had a job since 1969. And here I am speaking to marketing presidents and CEOs. And the last job I had, I was a cook in a hospital, which didn't have much marketing value. And before that, I was a busboy in a restaurant. And before that, I was working in a car wash, washing cars when I was a teenager. So that's my experience in marketing, as far as that goes, paying jobs. But I shared with them something that I felt was very important. That along with marketing our products, we must understand the effect that the culture, the integrity, and the values in which we do our work will affect the world. Because how you do something is actually going to have more effect sometimes than what you do. In the sense, you may be selling this product, but the way you sell it is what's going to affect the world tremendously. Wall Street recently came crashing down because of greed, because of ego, because of a lack of compassion for humanity or anyone. So you are here in India, you have such a great, deep spiritual culture. With your values, with your integrity, do your marketing. With that foundation, you can make a great contribution to change the world. Because essentially, that's what Bhagavad Gita is teaching. Bhagavad Gita is primary scripture of yoga, according to great acharyas and saints. And the person that Krishna chose to speak Bhagavad Gita to was not a sage living in the caves of the jungles of the Himalayas. He spoke to Arjuna. He wasn't a swami. He was married. He had children. And he had the least likely job to be a yogi. Some people ask, how could I be a yogi if I'm in business? How could be a yogi if I'm a farmer or if I'm in education? Well, Arjuna was a military man about to fight a war. Krishna wanted to make a very great emphasis that whoever you are, whatever you're doing, if you learn to do it build your life, your occupation, on the foundation of truth, principles of devotion and love and compassion. compassion, then you could be a perfect yogi in whatever you do. And that's what the opportunity we all have is. But the tendency is to procrastinate. I have something else to do today, and let me get this done tomorrow. And after I finish this, recently I spoke at Princeton University I was on stage with Dr. Cornel West, and he said something that I've quoted many times. He said, one of the problems in this world is we are constantly being bombarded by weapons of mass distraction. So many distractions. But here I was with a very beautiful saintly man who was expecting to die within a few days. So every moment was so precious. I didn't read the newspaper to him. We didn't turn on any televisions. These things really don't mean much of anything when you really go to the root of what's really important in life. We promised each other that we would only speak subjects about God, about Krishna, about Ram. We would only speak the philosophy of devotion and wisdom. And we would only speak about saintly people. And we would share our experiences and our realizations with each other. That 8 weeks was so beautiful. I never knew on this human level that there could be such deep love between two human beings. The love, not of the senses, enthusiasm to love God together. It was so deep, it was so wonderful. I remember one day, he was in so much pain. His entire body was shaking uncontrollably. His cancer would just go into all different types of variations. He went through every stage possible to the end. This is just close to the end. And I tried to speak to him, but I saw that he couldn't concentrate because his body was in so much turmoil. So I just began to chant this Maha Mantra. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama. And he started chanting with me. And suddenly, there was the most ecstatic, blissful, spontaneous smile on his face. And it was quite a smile, because he had a very black, dark face and very white teeth. He was smiling, and tears. I never saw him cry due to pain or anxiety or frustration, but tears of happiness, of joy, were flooding his eyes. And he held my hand, and he said, Swami, it doesn't get any better than this. Now, you're listening to me, but imagine being there. He was emaciated. He had tumors all over his body. One of his legs was amputated. He was about a third of his weight. And there he was, smiling and crying in ecstasy, telling me, it doesn't get any better than this. And I listened to him. And then he said, I would not trade. trade my place for anyone else in the world. And he said, I've never tasted the sweetness of God's names like I am today. I would not trade my place with anyone else. He just said, this is so beautiful. I know where I'm going, and I know where I am. These were the kind of moments we shared every day. Arrogance. And who will believe me if I tell the truth? I don't think anybody will. He said to me, your journey, it is the journey that everyone is on. It's beyond sectarian conceptions. Everyone is looking for happiness. Everyone is looking for meaning. Everyone is looking for fulfillment. And the experiences that God has given you, if they can help anybody else, then it is an act of arrogance not to write the book. And he held me by the hand and said, promise me on my deathbed you will write this book. What could I do? He was holding my hand. He wouldn't let go. So I promised him. But then when I walked out of the room, I decided I'm going to convince him to let me break my promise. But before I could do that, he died with hundreds of people all around him chanting God's names and praying and showing their love for him. He just went back to the Lord. So in honor of my friend, I wrote this book. The journey began when I was 19. I was born in 1950. I spent my teenage years in the 1960s in America. For those of you who know about America's sociology, it was a very turbulent time. There were revolutions, there were marches, there were demonstrations. I was seeing the National Guard, the internal American army, shooting and killing young girls who were college students, who were just demonstrating for peace. I myself was at such a demonstration, and I was tear gassed. And if I wasn't a really fast runner in those days, I would have been beaten like most of the rest of my friends by the clubs of the police, who I was told were protecting my freedom. It was a turbulent time. I was revolting against so many things that I considered hypocritical and unjust. But eventually I came to the realization that if we don't change our own hearts, we can't really do anything substantial for the world. That the real change has to be spiritual. So I went on a spiritual quest with one friend named Gary. We went to Europe with one other friend who was our sponsor, because we had no money. And the first day we were in Luxembourg, our friend got robbed and immediately went back to America. He expected us to come with him. Gary and I didn't have anything, but we had enthusiasm. So we stayed, and we were hitchhiking, and we were meeting people. And we were searching through synagogues and churches and cathedrals and monasteries and museums and natural mountains and rivers. And eventually we lived in a cave in the mountain of Crete, a Greek island. And there I was praying and meditating all day, every day, from sunrise to sunset. And I heard a voice. I knew if I followed these three words I heard, I would have to leave behind everything I knew about my life. My mother and father, loving parents, they were expecting me to come home and continue my college. I was only a teenager. Those three words were, "Go to India." So I went back to my friend in the cave, Gary, and I told him, "I'm leaving for India tomorrow." He said, "You don't have any money. You don't even know anyone in India." I said, "Well, you could come with me." He said, "I'm not going to. Hitchhiking through Europe is one thing, but hitchhiking through the Middle East, you are insane. You cannot do it." Anyways, the next morning at sunrise, I left my friend and started hitchhiking through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. The whole trip took 6 months to get to India. Now I do the same trip from London to India in 9 hours. But I can tell you, it's much safer in the airplane. It's much more comfortable in the airplane, but you don't get so many life-changing experiences. And finally, when I reached India, I came to Rishikesh in the Himalayas. It was the winter of 1970. And now I'll begin my talk. I took a third class train. In those days, third class trains is the way sadhus traveled. There were no bars in the windows. You jumped in the train when it was still moving, before it stopped in a railway station. You had to jump through the window, because by the time the train stopped, there was no possibility of fitting in the train. Probably 200 people in each car, with a capacity of about 60. And maybe 300, maybe 500. It was very crowded. So from Haridwar, I walked to Rishikesh alone. And I stayed at the Shivananda Ashram. And then I took a boat across because I wanted to find life in the jungle and live in seclusion for some time. So I went down the river, and in those days it was so quiet in Rishikesh. Probably 85% of the buildings that are here now were not here then. And I found a cave that I lived in. I went back to try to find the cave, and where the cave used to be is a hotel. Times change. But anyways, I was sitting on the bank of the Ganga and meditating alone for hour after hour after hour. And one holy man from a distance was walking toward me. I was in a place where there was no one else within a long distance. He was the only human I saw. He walked right up to me. He had long, grayish hair and beard. He was wearing flowing robes that were rippling in the river breeze. And he said, "I know who you are, but you do not know who I am." He said, I have been watching you from a distance, and I appreciate your determination. Now, take off your Western clothes and throw them in the Ganges. I will give you the robes of a sadhu. First time I ever heard this word. I said, what is a sadhu? He said, a sadhu is one who is a homeless wanderer seeking the truth. I considered that this must be something very divine that was happening. So I took off my pants. It was the only clothes I had. Because in Afghanistan, while I was running for my life from being killed, I left everything behind. I had no sleeping bag. I only had the clothes I was wearing. My gray pinstripe jeans. You know, if you only have one set of clothes, it really becomes part of your identity. I didn't realize how attached I was to these old clothes until I was told to throw them in the Ganga. I took off my jeans and they were swept away. And then I had a turtleneck shirt and a t-shirt. I took it off. It was standing in my underpants. He said, throw your underwear in the Ganga. This was becoming serious. Because in those days in India, they didn't have Western things. It was impossible to buy anything of the West in India in 1970. Now you could get anything. I was thinking there may not be another set of underpants 10,000 miles. At least that's what I was thinking. And they were fruit of the loom, rough underpants. So he gave me a sheet, just a sheet like this, but it was white. And I wrapped it around my waist, and then I took what's called copan, just two strips of cloth, about this big, wide. And he taught me how to put it on. And then I put one piece of cloth around my waist and one sheet of cloth around my top part. And that was my clothes. And that's all I wore for about the next year and a half. It was that. And then he whispered in my ears. He said, the Ganga will become your mother. You will understand this in time. And after saying that, he turned around and walked away, and I never saw him again. So after finding a nice little cave, I lived in many caves. Among caves, there's 5-star caves. This was probably a 2-star cave. It's very simple. But I decided I would fast and sit and meditate and pray for 1 month. And I saw a rock right in the middle of the Ganga. Not exactly in the middle, but maybe about 20 feet from the bank. So I kind of waded through it and climbed over a few other rocks, and I sat on that rock from sunrise to sunset every day. Just trying to learn about myself, about life and God. And I found it's so incredible. If we tune in to nature, especially spiritual nature like Ganga, if we really focus and tune in, how much wisdom we can access. Our minds are so distracted by so many things. It's so many times it's hard to really be in the moment. I learned more from sitting in silence on that rock in the Ganga more valuable knowledge than I did my whole life, 19 years of going to school. Can I tell you a few of those lessons that I learned? It was a very swift current all around me. And this was in December of 1970. The Ganga was so crystal clear and such deep, rich blue. It was just beautiful. I was watching the waves as they were flowing so rapidly. They were rippling and swirling. And I was thinking, this is the most beautiful masterpiece of art I have ever seen. No human artist could ever replicate this. If somebody paints a beautiful river, if it's a great master, people will spend millions of dollars to get that painting. But it can't compare to the actual river. And we can see for free. We'll pay money to go to a museum, we'll pay millions of dollars to get a painting of a river. But the real river, do we really appreciate? At every moment, such a masterpiece of art. The smell, the feel, the taste, the action. But then I was thinking that as soon as the masterpiece is created, it's gone. It's ever changing. Nothing is constant. But the current is constant. And in the same way, all the things that we become attracted to in this world are in a constant flux of change. We cannot cling to anything. By the power of current of time, everything is changing. Everything will be lost. But if we can appreciate the beauty of the current of truth that's constantly flowing beneath all the swirling waves of joy and sorrow, happiness and distress, pleasure and pain, honor and dishonor, success and victory, health and disease, then our happiness never changes. The secret is to go deep into ourselves and understand the depths of truth, even in this ever-changing world. Another day, I was looking at the Ganga. I was not far from here was this rock. I was looking upstream toward the Himalayas. And I was thinking how Ganga begins at Gangotri above that Gomukh and is flowing down from the peaks of the Himalayas and then down to the plains all the way to Ganga Sagara, where it enters into the sea. But there are so many obstacles in Ganga's path. I saw there's huge rocks that fall in the Ganga. There's giant mountains that are blocking the Ganga. There's massive trees that fall in the Ganga. But somehow or other, Ganga Devi flows over, under, or around any obstacle to reach the sea. In the same way, if we want to find the sea of our aspiration, we must learn from Ganga how there's always a way. We should never, ever, ever be discouraged by inevitable impediments and obstacles that will come on our path. But rather, we must learn to somehow or other flow over, under, or around them all and never give up. Because with the grace of God, nothing is impossible. I was sitting on the rock, and the current was flowing so fast, and I was thinking, if I was in the current, it would really be difficult. I would be getting thrown around by every wave that comes, and I'd be bouncing off rocks, and I don't know what would happen to me. But when I'm sitting on this rock, outside of the current, or on the bank, everything is peaceful, and I could just observe and learn so many beautiful lessons. And in the same way, when we get caught up due to attachments and desires to the things going on in this world, we just become so much affected by everything. But wisdom means to observe, to understand who I am. I'm the Atma. I'm the living force. I'm the spirit soul. I'm eternal. Seeing through my eyes, hearing through my ears, tasting through my tongue, feeling through my flesh, thinking through my brain, loving through my heart. Who am I? I am the witness. And as long as we think we're this body and think we're this mind and think, then we're affected by all the unpredictable situations that come upon us. But if we just step back and try to see things from the perspective of who we really are, then we could watch life flow by, and we could learn from it, and we can access so much grace. One day when I was sitting on the bank of the Ganga, on that rock, I was sitting in silent meditation for about 10 hours a day. But I was just listening to the beautiful current. It's very loud. But not like that. And I started for the whole day, day after day, I just sat and listened to Mother Ganga. And one day I heard a sacred syllable, Om. It sounded like it was being chanted by millions of voices. And for days and days, that's all I did, is listen to Om coming from Ganga. And then very mystically, I heard from Ganga's heart, as if thousands of celestial voices singing this Maha Mantra. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram. As far as I remember, it's the first time in my life I ever heard it. But I was praying and crying for direction. What is my path? Where am I supposed to be? Every day after I would sit after the sunset on my way back to the cave, there was one old man who was sitting on the ground. And he had a burlap sack, and he just emptied it out and put it on the ground and sold some vegetables. And I didn't have money, but he saw that I was dressed like a sadhu, and by this time my long hair was getting matted. I always wanted to grow a beard, but I just couldn't do it. Nothing came out. But anyways, he would give me one carrot. It was a very crooked looking carrot. And every day, that was my diet. I would drink as much Ganga water as I wanted, and I ate that one carrot in the cave. When the month ended, somebody happened to give me 1 rupee, which in those days was equal to about 7 cents. And I decided I'm going to celebrate the end of my 1 month fast and get 1 rupee worth of food. So I was wondering, what can I get for 1 rupee? So, you know where, what is that? What is that one store, that restaurant? Choki, what is it? Chotiwala, yeah, near Chotiwala. There was a peanut seller. And I thought I'd get a little bag like this for 7 cents. But I gave him a rupee, and he looked at that rupee and started taking newspapers. And in this very artistic way, he patched these he started folding newspapers together to make a grocery bag about this big and filled it to the top with peanuts. And I must confess, I always loved peanuts. And they were roasted in sand and hot, and I could smell them. Because carrots don't smell so much, you know, but these peanuts smell so good. But I was taught by sadhus that we're not supposed to eat in public. So I decided to take this big grocery bag of peanuts back to my cave, where I would feast. And as I was walking through the forest, smelling the peanuts, feeling the peanuts, in my mind I was tasting the peanuts, and I can tell you, I was really anticipating eating the peanuts. Suddenly, a large, in fact a huge, male monkey, brown in color, blocked the little forest path and looked at me with such intimidating eyes. His glance was, I am going to kill you. That's what I was hearing from his glance. And then he showed his teeth. He had those sharp fangs, and he opened his mouth as far as he could, and he screamed, "You're laughing." So it wasn't very effective. I wasn't laughing. He screamed at me, showed me his fangs, looked at me with such anger, and then started kind of little jumps toward me to show was in charge. Then suddenly he really screamed extra large, loud, and jumped right toward me. He was flying in the air right toward me. And then he came right up, and his teeth and his face were right inches from my face. I could smell his breath. I thought he was going to bite my nose off. And quickly, with his rear legs, he kicked me really hard in the chest, and with his arms, he grabbed the bag of peanuts, and I fell back, and he ran away with the peanuts. All of them. Except some of them fell to the ground while we were fighting. It wasn't a fight, but during the skirmish. And I was thinking, well, at least I'll get a few peanuts. But then a few little baby monkeys jumped out of somewhere and picked up every little peanut and ran away. I wasn't left a single nut. My stomach was growling, but I was learning how to to see every situation in life as an opportunity to grow. Because that is the reality. That's what every moment of life, however mysterious it may be, that's what it's for. To bring us closer to God. So I asked the Lord in my heart, what am I supposed to learn from this? And then I got some thoughts that compared to the incredible nourishment, the incredible treasure of the knowledge and the inspiration and the grace that I received over the last month on that rock. Everything in this whole world is like peanuts. But in this world, people are so addicted to these peanuts, they will lie, die, cry for those peanuts. But they do not know that at any moment, the monkey of another person's greed, or ultimately the monkey of death, is going to snatch away all our cherished peanuts. But if we can attach ourselves to what is eternal, what is real, what is truth, who is God, the monkey of time cannot take that away. Ever since that moment, to this day, 42 years later, I consider that monkey one of my gurus. He taught me such an important lesson. From there, I traveled to different places. I went to Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's ashram, Shankaracharya Nagar, which was now it's no more. And I lived with one sage in a cave named Tatwala Baba. And I stayed with Swami Chidananda of Shivananda, who was the successor of Swami Shivananda. And then I decided to travel north, higher into the Himalayas. I learned some incredible lessons from another one of my gurus. She was an old dying woman with leprosy in the midst of a leprosy colony. The lepers were so poor, there was literally no one in the world that cared about them. But she cared about me. It's written about in the book. And I went higher to Dev Prayag, where by a very mysterious incident, I encountered a sage named Kailash Baba. He was a huge man. Of course, I'm small, so everything's big related to compared to me, but he was very big. It's like a mountain. And he carried a trident, and he had one of those Damura drums, and he had long matted hair. He was probably in his late 60s. I was just turning 20. And he took me in like his own son, and treated me just like a father. It was just the two of us wandering through the wilderness of the Himalayan jungles. And he's been doing it since he was a little boy. So he really knew how to live this life. So he was training me in the life of a wanderer. He taught me which herbs I could eat, which leaves I could eat, which I shouldn't eat. He was teaching me certain things that were medicinal. this out of bags. It shouldn't be to get something. It should be to give people the opportunity to serve God through a sadhu. But how a sadhu has to really be a man of God in order for that to work, or a woman of God, whatever. He taught me how to live among leopards, cobras, vipers, wild boars, wild elephants, because we'd see them from time to time. Big male elephants, we'd be sleeping and maybe we'd look up and every now and then a leopard, a lot of snakes. He taught me how to live among them. Like to know? He said, if you fear them, or if you feel yourself superior to them, then you are their enemy, and they will attack you. But if you have no fear of them, and you honor and respect the Lord within their heart, that every living being is a part of God. Every living being is a child of God. On that level, we are all equal. If you give them that honor and respect, then they will honor and respect you, and they will not harm you. Now, it's one thing when you learn something in school, and then you have some time to study it and to understand it. But these animals and snakes were there. So I had to actually assimilate it immediately. It was a crash course. And he taught me even more difficult than dealing with cobras and leopards and vipers and monkeys and boars and elephants is learning how to honor and respect different sects of sadhus. They could start cursing you and all these other things. So he was teaching me how to do all these things, how to be humble and respectful and see the divinity in everyone's heart. He taught me how to eat, how to bathe in the river, how to make soap out of mud. Coming from Chicago, this was all a very cultural experience living with Kailash Baba. But I want to tell you one thing that was really interesting about it. He taught me so much. He did not speak any English, and I did not speak any Hindi. He never spoke. He taught all these things to me just by gestures, just by motions. And I understood that communication is something very deep. Today there's many seminars and classes on communication skills. But I learned from Kailash Baba that if you really deeply love a person and care about them and really want to help them, and if somebody really wants to learn, then there's no barriers to communication. We don't need language. The language of the heart, the language of love, the language of care can actually overcome so many of these so-called shortcomings. After some time, I understood that he was a hermit and he wanted to be alone, and I knew I had to move on, so I left him. And just close by in Dehradun, I lived with Ananda Mayi Ma. This way I wandered through the Himalayas. I went was meeting various mystics who were performing very supernatural activities that were defying our conception of how nature works. And I was meeting different people again and again who could do these things. I write about them in the book. And after some time, it just didn't impress me. It's just the difference between them and most of us is they know how to do it and we don't. They were teaching me that if you understand through the power of the mind to manipulate the subtle elements of material nature, then you can do incredible things with the gross objects. In days of past, many people knew these sciences. But today, you know, we think we're so scientifically advanced and achieved, which we are on one level, but it's so much on the gross elements that there's hardly anybody who knows how to actually, on that psychic yogic platform, to actually connect with that deeper reality. And I came to learn that something far greater and deeper spiritually than performing so-called supernatural powers was to be humble, to be genuinely compassionate, and to actually love. That's what I wanted. That's what I was yearning for. Eventually, I traveled down to Bodh Gaya, where I studied Buddhism, and I sat under the Bodhi tree and meditated and learned Zen meditation and Vipassana meditation. I lived in Varanasi, and from sunrise to sunset, I sat at the burning ghats and watched body after body being burned, transformed into ashes and swept into the Ganges. I was meditating on the nature of this body, because it's going to happen to all of us. Either we're going to be put in fire or put in the ground. What is it that's really, really valuable? That was my meditation. As the Bible says, to be in this world, but not of this world. But to not be of this world, we have to be in another world. That's the inner world, the spiritual world within us. And in my travels, I eventually came to Bombay, where I took a meditation course. And I was sitting for about 12 to 14 hours a day in different types of meditation. And I decided at the end of the 14-day course, I just wanted to walk. I had no shoes. When I was in the Himalayas, somewhere near Dev Prayag, I lived with the Naga Babas. And an incident took place there where I renounced shoes. So I was wandering barefoot. And there I was wandering barefoot in Bombay, and I saw a big sign for a spiritual festival. So I went into this gigantic tent. And in the evening, there was about over 20,000 people gathered to hear this guru speak. And I was way, way in the back. When the guru came on stage, there were disciples chanting kirtan before he came. When he came, I was so far away. He looked so effulgent and so beautiful and so graceful and so compassionate. I wanted to be closer, but I didn't. I was shy to step in front of anyone else because everyone was already sitting. So then I saw the guru. He called one of his disciples and said something to him. And then his disciples were looking for several minutes through the crowd and started signaling to someone to come. But no one came. He kept signaling. He was going like this. Then he got down off the stage and started walking through thousands and thousands and thousands of people till he came to the very back of the crowd. He walked right up to me and took me by the hand and said, "Srila Prabhupada wants you to sit with him." I said, how does he know me? And he didn't answer my question. He just said, "Come," and pulled me. And he pulled me through all the crowds of people and took me on the stage and brought me right up to the Guru. And the Guru, very humble, very gracious, and the words he spoke, and the sound of his beautiful voice, the wisdom penetrated deep in my heart. And then after the lecture, he said I could sit there with him on the stage for the whenever he gives class, which was going to be for the next 2 weeks, every morning and evening. So I came. Affected. My heart was saying, "This is your guru." But my mind was saying, "No, there's so many more people to meet and so many more things to see and so many places to go." So eventually I left after the 2 weeks was done and the program was ended. I've traveled again. But that person was the person who later on would become my guru. I traveled down to Ganesh Puri, and I went to Goa to try to get a visa, and then I went back up to the Himalayas and lived with the Dalai Lama and those his lamas and monks. And then I was traveling, and I was in Pashupatinath in Nepal. One day, I was walking through a field. I'm not going to tell that story because it takes too long. But I was on my way to Amarnath from Nepal, which is in Kashmir, for a pilgrimage to Lord Shiva. And on my way, I got stranded in a very unknown place. I was on an overcrowded train. It got caught in a flood in the monsoons in a field, and I didn't sit down, eat anything, or drink anything in about 40 hours. And it was really hot. So the first station that finally stopped in, I crawled out the window, and I drank water, and I breathed fresh air, and I walked. And when I went to get on the train again, it was so crowded I couldn't get in a window, I couldn't get in a door. So the train was gone and I was stranded. And I asked one sadhu on the side of the railway platform, "Where am I?" He said, "This is Mathura, Krishna's birthplace. And today is Janmashtami, Krishna's birthday. Let me take you to the place where Krishna was born." So I was quite flexible in those days as far as my scheduling. And then I went and I was very moved by the experience, but I decided after 3 days I will leave and go to Amarnath, to the pilgrimage for Shiva. I was sleeping on the bank of the river Yamuna. And on the morning I was supposed to leave, I could not move. I had typhoid fever. I had very high. I was the sickest I'd ever been in my life. so I couldn't travel. And by the time I got better, I fell in love with Vrindavan, and fell in love with the people of Vrindavan, and fell in love with the path of bhakti, and fell in love with Sri Radha, the supreme feminine aspect of the supreme absolute truth, and fell in love with Krishna. I had learned so many things about God. God is all-powerful. God is the creator of all creations. God is all-knowing. God could punish us. These are the different things I learned, especially in the religions I grew up with. But I found in Vrindavan that, yes, God is all these things and unlimitedly more. But beyond it all, God is supremely sweet, supremely beautiful, supremely loving, supremely compassionate, supremely humorous, supremely playful. God is supremely lovable. And that sweet nature of God is what is focused on in the path of bhakti. Charmed my heart, answered my questions. And about 6 months later, while I was living under a tree on the bank of the river Yamuna in Vrindavan, that same guru came back to Vrindavan, Srila Prabhupada. And by hearing him and feeling his compassion, I accepted this life. One day, recently, I called my father on the phone. Now he's 88 years old. This happened about 2 years ago. 1.5 years ago, to be exact. I asked him, "Father, how are you?" He said, "Terrible." Now, my father's always very positive. I never heard him talk like this before. I said, "What's wrong?" He said, "I didn't sleep all night." I said, "What happened?" He said, "Before going to sleep, I was reading your book." this was in the bank of the Ganga, my mother, at Prayag, where the Ganga and the Yamuna meet. Huh? Not Dave, but Prayag. Prayag, where Yamuna, Ganga, and Saraswati meet. It was the Sangam. I swam across to the other side, and there was no one around, only quicksand. And my father said, and then you somehow or other just kind of very slowly crawled out of the quicksand and went into the Ganga, and the Ganga was so forceful, pushing you back into the quicksand. And you were drowning. And I remember I was drowning and drowning, and I was swimming against the current, and the Ganga was going so fast. And I was going backward toward the quicksand. And then I realized that I'm going to die. And I was thinking, better than die in the quicksand, Ganga's my mother, let me just die in the Ganga. So I just lost all my strength, swimming, and I was underwater. And while I was underwater, that same Maha Mantra came into my heart. The same Maha Mantra I heard up here in Rishikesh. And I was thinking, beautiful. I'll die chanting this mantra given to me by Ganga in the Ganga. But then, all of a sudden, a thought came into my mind. See, what happened is, as I was swimming, an old guy on a boat came sailing by, just maybe 20 meters in front of me. And I was screaming to him to save me. And he just looked at me and went like this. And then went, just sailed by. He was gone. And I just thought he abandoned me. But when I was underwater and I chanted the mantra, then I thought, what he meant by that is, don't swim against the Ganges current. Swim with the Yamuna's current across the Ganges. I never thought of that. And I did, and I was saved. So my father told me this whole story. And he said to me, if you would have died in that quicksand, no one would have ever heard about you again. My mother and me, your mother and myself, we would have spent the rest of our lives without any closure wondering, where are you? Are you dead or alive? And you were that close to dying in that way where we would have never heard about you. He said, I was tossing and turning in agony all night thinking of what would have happened years ago. I'm not in quicksand anymore. I'm quite happy, actually. And his reply, I'll never forget. He became very stern, raised his voice, and said, you do not understand the heart of a father. But my father, so far, he has given away 5 cases of these books.